We're halfway there. 093071, Keller versus Indiana Family and Social Services. And it's Mr. Kimball. How are you?
Thank you, Your Honor. Roger, if Your Honor may please the court, I represent Bill Keller and Ronnie Gullion. They're state employees at the Madison State Hospital for mentally ill individuals in southeastern Indiana. The main complaint is that they and their fellow male co-workers have always had to basically handle the physical restraints of patients. Now, at some point before 2005 or 2006, according to Mr. Keller and Mr. Gullion, the hospital actually had a policy that they said was a BFOQ, whereby the men were always sent in to handle unruly patients. Then, at some point in that time frame, the hospital changed the policy, and it was to the effect that all staff members were to respond and participate in restraining unruly and violent patients.
Could I stop you for a minute? Because I want to ask you this. Do we really have two different cases here? In other words, one before Code Green and one after Code Green. In other words, you have some evidence that they called only men before that policy went into effect.
Right.
But once it went into effect, where is the evidence that women were exempt?
Well, the evidence is the plaintiff's rather comprehensive anecdotal evidence that when these Code Greens were called, women certainly did respond, but men did all the work of restraining the individuals. I just counted the incidents in Mr. Keller's answers to interrogatories. There's approximately 15 incidents that he recounts. And between him and Gullion, there was one time that they could recall that a woman actually got involved in one of these incidents, and she was injured and complained about having to handle an unruly patient.
Now, is this after Code Green went into effect?
The accumulation of incidents started in 2005.
No, I need to know if the woman was injured after Code Green went into effect or before Code Green.
I don't know if that's clear in the record, Your Honor. I don't recall that there was a time frame given to that particular incident. But the plaintiffs testified that was a situation. Basically, the men were doing all the work. There's quite a bit of evidence that the women complained about even going to the Code Greens. Certainly, they didn't want to participate in them. They made that well known. Oftentimes, the female supervisors specifically asked for individual men or men to handle situations.
Mr. Kimball, what evidence was before the district court of similarly situated women?
Well, the evidence is that they had a classification called psychiatric, I think it's psychiatric assistant 4. And everybody that worked on one of these units was either a nurse or a psychiatric attendant, I think it was, 4. And they were all obligated to respond to Code Greens, although nurses not so much as the psychiatric attendants. Now, Gullion is a nurse, and that's one reason why he didn't get involved in these as often as Mr. Keller. But the plan under Code Green was that all the staff members, nurses, psychiatric attendants, were to participate in Code Greens. They all got trained for Code Greens. The, of course, the psychiatric attendant 4s had the same job title, the same supervisors, the same pay, same training to participate in Cold Greens. So that's the evidence that they're similarly situated.
But were there specific women identified who were similarly situated to the plaintiffs here?
Actually, probably not in that sense, but both the plaintiffs testified that on their ward there were a certain number of women, there were a certain number of men. Usually it was 50-50, maybe a few more women, 4 and 2, 3 and 3. And they were all, like I said, same job titles, same pay, same bosses, same training, same response. They did respond. Everybody responded to Cold Greens. But after they started the Cold Greens, like I say, the problem was that the men did all the heavy lifting, just like they always had. At least now there were women there, but that was about the only change. But as far as individual women, there are individual women named in the answers to interrogatories with specific incidents of their being there, their behavior, and so forth and so on. I maintain that, and this is basically a case of a practice of discrimination, and there's really no counter evidence from the other side that, okay, here's a case where a woman participated, or here's three cases, or anything like that. All the testimony is from the men, and their testimony is that they did all this work while the women didn't. So it's just the accumulation of evidence, the lack of any countervailing evidence, that that basically the men have to do the heavy lifting. And it seems to me that when you have a similarly situated conglomeration of people, and one of one sex are doing all the hard work and the other one over here aren't, that's it's either an adverse act or it's an adverse practice. It's just common sense.
Mr. Kimball, what are you arguing was the adverse employment action? I wasn't certain if you were saying it was the taking away the cards, not allowing them to wear shorts, or something else.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, my hearing is...
I'm sorry. What are you claiming was the adverse employment action against your clients?
It's more a practice than an action, Your Honor. The fact that they were having to do harder work than the women is, as I said, an adverse act. And there's actually a case that says that. I didn't say it in my brief, but it's Ford versus General Motors Corporation. Mr. Ford worked at General Motors Corporation, and that's a 305 F3rd 545. It's a Sixth Circuit case. Either it's an act or it's a series of acts, and therefore a practice.
So it's the harder work. That's what your focus of. That's what your adverse action is.
Excuse me?
It's the fact that they had to work harder for women. That's what your argument is.
Right. Do a harder, more difficult, more dangerous kind of work. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The other way you can look at this case is as a hostile environment case based upon this differential treatment and the other more niggling things that the men are complaining about, which is not being able to wear shorts, not being able to play poker, which by themselves, we wouldn't have a case. But when you add them to the main complaint, I think it's basically what happened here is the men were turned into second-class citizens at the institution. And so that I think that constitutes a hostile environment.
Into your rebuttal.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. You're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Rogers. Good morning.
Almost so.
I'm going to do something terrible. Before you even speak, I have to ask you a question.
Sure.
Okay. I want to focus for a moment on the time period before the Code Green policy went into effect, because in your BFOQ argument below, you seem to concede that during that time period, men were routinely singled out to subdue violent patients, mostly because men are larger in size, and size is important in subduing violent persons. If size is necessary in subduing violent patients, why is it no longer necessary under Code Green? In other words, that change in policy makes the BFOQ defense suspect. It makes it sound like pretext.
Well, Your Honor, we're not pursuing the BFOQ on appeal, and we would not ask for judgment to be entered on that in this case.
But our review is de novo.
And I understand that, Your Honor, but we don't even want that argument.
I mean, we can consider anything that was raised below. So, you know.
There was no actual evidence of a BFOQ policy, whereas in the Johnson control case, I think, that was cited in the appellant's brief, there was an actual policy put in front of the court that said, we are not going to allow women who are of childbearing age who haven't proved their infertility to be in lead-based jobs. So there was an actual policy that the employer had that said, we are making a differential treatment based on fertility. And the Supreme Court ultimately said, for other reasons, they had a policy in place. We're not going to accept it as a BFOQ, but they did have a policy.
Yeah, but look, you're the party seeking judgment.
Sure.
So you're the party that is charged with demonstrating that women as well as men were called in to subdue violent patients.
Right.
What's your best evidence of this? I mean, you've got this charge that says that these two men answered only 7 out of 277 Code Green calls in 1 year. But you don't tell us who answered the other 270. Was it men? Was it women? Was it a combination? On summary judgment, we cannot construe the facts in your favor. You have to actually tell us. You have to tell us.
You actually look at the exhibit attached to the affidavit of Deborah Woodfill, which was attached. Let me look at the attachment really quickly. On docket entry 36 of the district court's docket, attachment number 7, there was an exhibit of Deborah Woodfill.
And are you referring to the logs?
I am referring to the log, Your Honor. But it's cited in my brief according to the district court log. But it is part of the record. And attached to the back of that is an exhibit that goes through all of the Code Greens that were conducted.
And they basically show that men responded disproportionate amount.
Well, correct. To a certain extent, yes. But it also showed that women did respond to these Code Greens. And then in the actual affidavit that Ms. Woodfill and then Nurse Barbro submitted said there is no policy and procedure in place that shows preferential treatment of men, or not preferential treatment, but we would prefer to have men called to the Code Greens and over women. And I think it's important to note that the appellants in this case submitted no evidence to the district court.
But you can shoot yourself in the foot and be denied summary judgment because of evidence you submit, right?
Definitely, Your Honor. And the district court, I think, addressed that fact by saying they failed to file a statement of material facts in dispute according to Local Rule 56.1.
Why isn't this chart, among other things, at least evidence that is relevant and probative to show that despite any official policy of favoring one gender over another, in fact, the hospital had such a practice because the men were answering the bell a lot more than the women?
One of the reasons that wasn't argued by the plaintiffs in this case. They did not point the district court's attention to this evidence.
They're and it talking was about their memorandum, their response to
yes.
your memorandum for summary judgment.
Exactly. There was yes. no evidence designated. I mean, and they had every right to designate our own evidence against us. They did not do that. I was just going to say that was the district court's. The district court also found on the merits, but the district court's position was essentially They didn't introduce any evidence. The burden is on the plaintiffs in this case. The only evidence in this record is the evidence that the state of Indiana has put forth. It's uncontroverted. Based on the uncontroverted, competent evidence showing that there was no discrimination or discriminatory practices in place, they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
Your point is that the plaintiffs sandbagged the district judge.
What, I don't know what you mean by sandbag the district judge.
In other words, the district judge was not informed of the evidence upon which they relied to create a genuine issue of triable fact on whether there was a de facto practice of discrimination.
It was put in front of the district court in a sir reply, and the district court denied the plaintiff's motion to file a sir reply.
I understand. But it wasn't in this document.
Is that the response, Your Honor?
Their response.
Yes. There was no evidence in that document at all.
But you do admit that there is evidence in the record that might support at least a triable fact on the issue of whether there was a de facto discriminatory practice.
I understand Your Honor's point, and I agree with your point that the actual logs that the state of Indiana did introduce show that men do respond more often than women.
You know, in your brief in the district court, here's what you said, and I'm going to quote, "Presumably, since there is no gender policy per se, if there were 6 foot two to 6 foot four females weighing 275 pounds or more, they would also be expected to respond in more situations than smaller males or females." Why presumably? Doesn't the hospital know whether it has 300-pound women working there? I mean, this is summary judgment, so you have to actually support this assertion with facts. Is there anything in the record telling us that you had no women of adequate size to subdue violent patients?
There's no evidence in the record regarding the size of the women or versus the size of the men, and they attempted to attach that to the affidavit of Randy Wilkerson, and I believe that was stricken by the district court judge.
What do you mean they attempted?
The plaintiffs.
Attempted to do what?
Attach a handwritten sheet by the affiant Randy Wilkerson saying, you know, Jane Smith's height and weight.
Are you referring to this document that was attached?
I believe so.
To the Wilkerson affidavit?
I believe so. If you'll give me a second to look. I don't have that document, Your Honor, but I believe that was stricken by the district court judge, as was most of his affidavit. And a lot of the information that was stricken or not allowed by the district court judge was included as facts before this court. But that is, I mean, again, Your Honor, that's part of what I believe was said in front of the district court with respect to the BFOQ defense, which, you know, we are not seeking a judgment on the BFOQ defense.
Yeah, but we can.
And I understand Your Honors can affirm on any basis in the record, but it's not something that we even pursued on appeal to this court.
Why should either plaintiff have to name a specific similarly situated woman who was treated better when they have said unequivocally that all women were treated better?
Well, if you look at this court's opinions regarding similarly situated, that aspect of the indirect method test, in each case, particularly the ones cited in the appellant's brief, each time there was an individual named who was treated exactly the same or who was in the exact same situation but was treated differently based on a gender or a race or an age, I believe were the cases cited. Because what you have to do is you have to show that that person holds the same job description. That person is subject to the same decision maker. That person is subjected to the same standards that the employee challenging the action is. And if you don't name that person, then how are we going to know who you're comparing it to? Like, for example, a counsel indicated that I think Mr. Gullion is a nurse. Well, nurses typically didn't respond to code greens. So you'd need to name another nurse, or you'd need to name another LPN or a psychiatric attendant for that is in the exact same situation, subject to the same decision maker, particularly, who's not having to respond to these code greens. The only evidence in front of this court and in the pool of evidence in front of the district court is the evidence that the state of Indiana put in the record. I do see that I'm out of time, and I would ask that this court affirm the district court judgment in all respects.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I took the approach that the judge did strike the surreply, but she didn't specifically strike the evidentiary materials that were attached to it. So I think they're fairly in the record. I must say that...
Well, wait a minute. If she struck... all of it was struck.
Actually... I confess the record in this case was a mess. I'm doing the appeal, but I had to abandon retaliation claims because basically the evidence to support them wasn't in the record. So what I was working with was pretty much...
But the retaliation were things like they couldn't wear shorts and they couldn't play poker at work.
There was one, which I didn't really describe it, but there was one actual disciplinary... pretty serious disciplinary thing taken against a major taken against one of the plaintiffs. I did not describe that because, like I say, I couldn't make the case out of the record. But in defense of trial counsel, if I could have just a second, when he saw that BFOQ argument, that's what he argued against. And I believe the law is that if you make that argument and lose, you're admitting you discriminated. And so it kind of caught him off... off-key, I guess you could say.
Mr. Kimball,
come on back. You can't escape us. You can't escape that easily.
Almost. I have one more question for you. Your intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, are you abandoning that one on appeal?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
There was an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim?
I'm abandoning that.
Okay.
I'm trying to make things as easy as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Kimball and Ms. Rogers, the case is taken under advisement, and we thank you both and hope you have a nice trip back.